This is the current federal tax developments for the week of June the 3rd, 2024. Current federal tax developments are brought to you by Kaplan Financial Education and by your state society of CPA. Dollars, and we're here this week talking about a limited number of items that took place because, as you may remember, last week was Memorial Day to begin, and because of that, really it was a very, very quiet week in terms of tax developments. Not a whole lot went on. So we're going to talk about a couple of developments this week, one of which mainly is being talked about here because we want to illustrate some issues that I think a lot of times CPAs and their clients get confused about, or at least the client gets confused and then the CPA has to fix it, which also comes into play. In fact, in this case, it may very well have been a case like that, that somebody did something and eventually they ended up with an advisor who figured out that, yeah, that doesn't really work. And so we'll talk about the fix. But we'll start out discussing the IRS's announcement that, yes, direct file will continue to 2025. We talked about it earlier, you know, that they had said it had been a successful 24 test program, but hadn't really said if it would continue in 25. It will be continued and it will be expanded while they will still maintain other programs to assist taxpayers who wish to prepare their own return. So we'll talk a little bit about those programs. As well, we'll talk about this week's private letter ruling on fouling up your S-corporation election. Yes, I know we talked about that last week. But this particular private letter ruling was, at least as far as I can remember, unique in how many things the taxpayers fouled up at their S election and probably how quickly it appears they had to have noticed the foul up in order to get everything fixed. So a little surprising that the service basically allowed them to go back and do this. But the other side of that is it was also, I suspect, one where the fact it was caught very quickly made it pretty clear to the service that, okay, yeah, they really didn't intend to do this. They just didn't know what they were doing. And they did come clean early. So yeah, they got out of this. So we want to talk about this because if somebody doesn't notice the problem until we're past 3 years, and especially if you do what they did in this case, and I have definitely seen people want to do this with an S corporation, yeah, you may simply have a C corp historically that turns out hasn't paid taxes for a number of years, which could be a problem. So the first thing I'm going to discuss is the Internal Revenue Service's news release 2024-151, which was issued on May 30th of 2024. And this is the IRS's announcement regarding the Direct File program. Now, for those of you who may not remember, Direct File was the program that ran as a pilot this past year, where taxpayers could file their returns directly with the IRS. This is as opposed to the Free File program, where taxpayers would file their return by using services like TurboTax or other consumer tax processing programs. And if they met certain criteria, they could do it for free. This was meant to eliminate using those third parties because there has been discussion about whether there has been some misleading information, shall we say, that came forward that tried to upsell individuals on the paid versions of those products rather than using the free one. There's definitely been some issues. There were some issues a few years ago, you know, with using data that maybe they shouldn't have been using, or more recently, the whole bit about having those trackers on the site that collected information, you know, that were set up to collect information about individuals, even though I suspect we just had more straight up not knowing what they were doing when they designed a website, as opposed to necessarily intentionally sharing data with those people. But nevertheless, there's been some issues there that opened this up for the IRS to start this sort of program. The pilot program in 24 was very, very limited. Now, my home state of Arizona was one of the states that fully participated in the program. And so it was a little bit unique. New York as well was in a full participation mode. Other states were only federal return participation. But what the program had this year is, as always with the prior standard free file programs, these only people that had very simple returns essentially could participate in this program for free. So on this, the IRS indicated they're intentionally starting with simple, straightforward, easy returns, Also, I should note, by the time they got this out, it was well into tax season. That also meant that people that really wanted their refunds quickly probably didn't wait for this. You know, it took a while to get in. So it was definitely a preliminary program meant to serve a manageable number of taxpayers that the IRS could then test the program by doing that with. It was only available to taxpayers in a few states, and not just states that agreed to let you file the state at the same time, but essentially the IRS did not want to open this up nationwide. So there were a very, very few states, I believe it was 12, where taxpayers could file. As I noted, my home state of Arizona was one of those 12 where you could sign up and use the direct file program. And then even fewer states than the 12 that signed up allowed you to also file a state return. As we know, you know, unless we're in a state that does not have an income tax, generally a taxpayer is going to need to file their state return. And of course, not being able to file the state return for free may very well eliminate the consideration of using the free federal return, because you got to file a state return anyway. And if there's no easy way to get that filed, you know, basically they may end up going for a paid solution or through the standard free file program. Now, the IRS said, coming forward, they said, they noted previously the success of the program and how it had proven popular with individuals who had been part of it when they did various surveys of them. So they'd indicate it was doing well, but they were going to consider it. Now they said, look, this program is going to be, we're recommending it become permanent, and we are also planning to not limit the number of states that could participate. Last year, the IRS had a cap on how many states they would let in, right? It was not going to be the whole country. This year, now, it's not clear from the way they worded this whether they are saying it'll be open to the whole country, but certain, you know, but all, as many states as might want could basically integrate this with their own state filings, or whether they're saying, nope, you know, the states have to be coming along and helping for their residents to be part of this program, even if they're not going to be involved with the state income tax filing. So that was a little bit unclear from the ruling. I've seen a lot of people assume this means that essentially you'll be able to file the federal return in every state, and then, you know, we'll see how many states want to integrate their state filings. They are looking to expand the types of returns that can be filed via the program. So, in essence, expand it up, and they said there'll be an emphasis here on using, you know, the type of forms that are often filed by families, you know, people with families and the like. Probably not going to concentrate on figuring out if they can serve a taxpayer who has 38 rental properties, right? That may be one that they're going to say, sorry, you got to go find somebody else to do it. But they are looking to expand it so it won't be as limited as it was this year. They will be announcing the details of the 25 programs. All we know is there's going to be a 25 program, and it should be much larger than 24 program, but actual details of how it's going to work, that will be announced in the coming months by the IRS. They also assured everyone that Direct File will not replace the Free File Inc. program, that recently they had signed a 5-year extension with that group to continue to provide free filing using the, you know, various standard commercial products that can be used by individuals for filing. So essentially, there'll be two ways to come in and file the return for free. You can use Direct File, or you could use the free version of one of the other programs. So that will still go on going forward. In addition, the IRS announced that they plan to strengthen the Voluntary Income Tax Assistance Program, VITA, as well as the Tax Counseling for the Elderly Program, TCE. Those are programs that essentially assist taxpayers in getting their return filed. It provides, in essence, some personal counseling, you know, in order to get that done. Obviously, the Direct File program generally would not provide personal counseling. It just provides a way to go online and file your return, presuming you know how to file the return, you know, that you know enough to be able to properly file it. So, you know, those programs are definitely a different class of program because they're trying to work with people who may want some hand-holding through the process. So Nevertheless, the direct file program appears to be here to stay, or at least through next year. So we'll see how everything works from there. Next up, we have the private letter ruling I was discussing. This looks into the fun bit about check the box. This is private letter ruling 2024-22-006, issued on Friday, May the 31st of 2024. Now, basically, many taxpayers and their advisors get really confused about various aspects of the check-the-box regulations. For those who are not aware, check-the-box discusses when we have something that's not a corporation, that is not considered a corporation, a trust, or a partnership under state law. You know, how exactly do we classify that? Because the Internal Revenue Code only knows about a few types of entities. And so other entities have to be fit into one of those categories. And the check the box rules have special rules that if an entity meets certain criteria, not automatically considered to be a corporation under the rules, it will have the ability to choose its entity type. Best known for limited liability companies. The check the box regulations are found at Regulation 301.7701-3, and they outline the basic rules for this. In this case, as I said, this ruling revolves around a limited liability company attempting to use check the box and a special subpart of check the box that noted that if we're going to pretend an LLC is a corporation, then we also can, subject to conditions, pretend it's made a proper S election. That in essence, a pretend LLC corporation. I do emphasize this is pretend, it's tax only. This thing is still an LLC for every other purpose. Yeah, don't confuse that. I see people confuse that all the time. Dangerously this year, I'm seeing it confused regularly when individuals are looking at whether they have to file a beneficial ownership information report with FinCEN, and you know, we'll ignore for the moment whether the whole FinCEN reporting thing is unconstitutional or not, because I think it's a little bit of a stretch to believe we're going to get that fully resolved by the end of the year. But I will say that if that's valid, and even in other contexts, if we're not talking about Title 26 United States Code, basically the Internal Revenue Code, an LLC is an LLC. And it doesn't matter what it claimed it was for income tax purposes. It is still a state law LLC. Legally, for liability purposes, it's an LLC, right? All of those things fall through. It's an LLC for those purposes. And most importantly, for purposes of the check the box rules, it is still an LLC. Now, those in Arizona, you guys should really understand this because due to quirks in our law, using LLC for S corporations, some people really like that, because corporations have to file detailed documentation about owners of their entity every year with the Arizona Corporation Commission, you know, involving that at least for any owner who owns more than 20% of the entity. But LLCs only have to file once and say, you know, these are the owners right now at formation, and never have to file again. And yet I still run into some Arizona CPAs that miss the BOI thing. Then I understand this part, that the LLC is an LLC. We're looking at filing with the state of Arizona for a report for an entity, but miss the whole fact that maybe the feds mean that too. Yeah, they do. So in any event, we have options for the limited liability company under the check the box rules at Reg 301.7701-3. Now, there are default rules for a domestic entity. These rules are a bit different for a foreign entity. For a domestic entity, if there is only one owner, one equity holder ultimately is deemed to hold all the interest in the LLC, then the LLC can elect to be either a disregarded entity or it can elect to be treated as a corporation. If it makes no election upon formation and it has a single owner, it will be by default disregarded. Now, if this is a foreign entity that qualifies to go through check the box, the rules are a little different and messier, and we're not covering those today, except to say it's another way people get things wrong and we end up with private letter rulings. So we'll leave it at that point. If the entity has more than one owner, then its choices are no longer to be disregarded because we can't use that anymore. It's either a tax partnership or it's a corporation. And notice I just said corporation, because we're just looking at the entity it falls under. Now, once you've got your entity type in there, you can make the same elections that any such entity can make. So if you have an LLC taxed as a partnership, and let's say that one of the members sells their interest to a new member, then the LLC taxed as a partnership can make a 74 election, even though that election is only available to partnerships under the Internal Revenue Code. I want to keep reminding you that. These are all IRC things. Similarly, a corporation, LLC that's elected to be treated as a corporation for the purposes of the Internal Revenue Code, is allowed to make an S election. Right. And regulation, section 7701 will tell you right up front, if you read it, it says for purposes of this title. This title, 26 of the United States Code, is what it refers to. And Title 26 United States Code is what we know of and call the Internal Revenue Code. So basically, whatever you do for check the box here applies. You might say there's a little caveat when we talk about payroll tax issues. That's only because of the special liability rules that attach to LLCs. And again, tax law doesn't determine liability of owners. State law does. And so because we have some quirks there, we don't really totally disregard, because for payroll tax purposes, for instance, you need to get an EIN for your disregard entity LLC that's held by an individual. By the way, remember, disregarded means we just treat it as if the owner of the interest, whatever that owner might be, where that owner is an individual, a corporation, an S corporation, right? So C corporation, S corporation, trust, whatever it might be, a state, we disregard the existence of the LLC and treat the owner of the interest, whatever that might be, as if they directly own the assets. And for that reason, the income that's coming from those assets and activity are going to be reported directly by that party on their tax return. So that's how this works. So as I said, we have this rules for checking the box. Today's case is going to involve a multiple member LLC that wishes to elect to be taxed as, that did elect to be taxed as a corporation, but then later decided to make an S election. And things were done very, very, very problematically in creating this S corporation. Or I'll tell you, practical answer is they never created one. They never had a valid S, and that's why this private letter ruling had to be requested. Okay. Now, per regulation 7701-3C1VC, an LLC being treated as a corporation that is eligible to be an S corporation can make both the election to be treated as a corporation and the election to have that corporation treated as an S corp by simply filing Form 2553. Now, that's not what they did here. So here, we already had we're going to have an LLC that already made the corporate election, right? Had apparently operated as a C corp for some period of time and then made the S election. And so they would just file the 2553 at that time, because the entity was already, for tax purposes, a corporation. So only the S election mattered to get the S status going forward. Now, a deemed conversion, if you have this brand new entity, or one that's treated currently as a partnership or a proprietorship, the conversion to the corporation under, we hope, 351, hopefully we qualify for the 351 transaction, but you have to check, because again, this is maybe a pretend world, but these pretend transactions have very, very, very real tax consequences, which means if it would have been taxable to take this fact situation and instead of putting those assets and liabilities into an LLC and electing corporate status, you would put them into a corporation, corporate structure in your state. If that would have been a taxable event, it's still going to be taxable if you put those assets in an LLC and make the check the box election to be a corporation, because you just did effectively the same thing. You finally told us what we're going to treat this thing as. And once we do that, that's what it was. It's a corporation. And the rules of the Internal Revenue Code governing taxable status of a formation transactions or a corporation would apply. Now, as I said, the LLC, if you do the formation thing, must still separately meet the requirements for eligibility to make the S election. And that's true in this case where this already electing to be treated as a corporation and having filed C returns before, LLC attempts to make the S election with a 2553. So we have to make sure that our LLC is eligible. Now, some of those things we know, we can't have any non-resident alien owners, ignoring some quirky ways you can structure, since the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act, a grant or trust to make an election to be a small electing small business trust that then has a foreign corporate, a foreign non-resident alien as its only beneficiary, and the person treated as a grantor, they could still own the shares. It's really weird how that ruling all came down. And we covered it years ago when it came out. So just realize there is a way to get a non-resident alien shareholder. It just may be very expensive tax-wise, but we can get one if we need to. So there is a way around it, weird as it may be. Okay. Important thing to remember about check the box. I've already mentioned this. This is an Alice in Wonderland pretend world. As I said, the Internal Revenue Code does not have any rules that tell us directly what to do for tax purposes with an LLC. I have to tell you, it is a question that can that on its own makes no sense if you ask what's the proper tax treatment. You know, these three people formed an LLC. You know, how should they be taxed? The first question is going to come back, did they make a check-the-box election? And if so, what entity type did they elect? Right? Because we have to get to the tax type. And that's the whole purpose here is to classify it. Prior to the check-the-box elections, and I do remember that, it was a time period when the first LLCs showed up, began in Wyoming back in the 70s, until we got check-the-box in the 90s, where every time you had an entity that didn't directly fit the category of, you know, we don't know if it's a corporation or not, we would have to go through these attribute tests, and then using them, which weren't totally clear, you had to figure out whether your thing, your LLC, was more like a corporation or more like a partnership. And if it was more like a corporation, you got corporate treatment. If it was more like a partnership, you got partnership treatment. And by the way, I should note, during that time period, before the check the box rules, there was no way you could make an S election just on a whim for an LLC that had been properly taxed as a partnership. You had to change the operating agreement in some way, shape, or form to force it to be a corporation first before you could make an S election, which can be kind of messy. And I know of virtually nobody that did it during that time frame. But nevertheless, that's what's there. So the whole check the box routine is an Alice in Wonderland make-believe, right? Jim Hamill, who I've mentioned before when he lectures, he basically uses a different term. He says this whole thing is a bunch of lies. We're going to lie about what it is, but then we're going to have a bunch of consistent lies to maintain the fiction. And we have to keep getting taxed under those consistent lies. So if that makes more sense for you, go that route. So we pretend certain things are not what they truly are, but we treat them as if they were like a corporation under state law in order to then classify them under federal tax law and figure out how to tax them. So that's what we do in check the box. Now, as limited liability companies do not issue stock, we have to come up with our stock stand-in. I have had too many people say, and this is where you could get the situation we're going to have right here. You can end up getting it very easily when people have come to the conclusion that the, you know, this one class of stock rule, which is what we're going to talk about here today, the one class of stock rule doesn't apply if it's an LLC because the LLC has no stock. Well, if I take you literally there, then we have zero stock, and no, you got to have stock, right? So what we do is we have to find the stock to then test, you know, what are we going to find that's equivalent of stock that we're then going to test for compliance with the rules found in the regulations to comply with the one class of stock rule found at Internal Revenue Code Section 1361B1D. You know, how do we find that? What is it? And, you know, how do we make that work? Well, Regulation 1.1361-1L1. That's, depending upon the font you're using, it'd be really fun to read that one. It can look like 111 or LLL. It's just lower, all lowercase L's or all ones. It can be tough to figure out what it is. But in this case, 1361-1, first regulation or 1361, L, subsection L, and then subsection 1 under that rule defines what meets a one class of stock rule. And what it basically says there is all outstanding shares, or in this case, whatever we're treating as the share of stock in the LLC. And again, we're going to have shares, plural, right? So whatever we treat as that stock stand-in, every one of those shares has to have identical rights in two areas. That includes for distributions, proceeds, so that's your regular yearly distribution, the proceeds from that, and liquidation proceeds. And I should say, it's an important word there, when we talk about rights. The rights matter, not necessarily what's done. What do I mean by that? You do not need an actual disproportionate distribution at all, ever, to run afoul of the one class of stock rule. You just need to have an operating agreement that when we check the stock, right, and we look at the rights, that there would be a situation where each share of stock would not get the same amount, have rights to get the same amount for regular distributions each year, nor would they have the right to get the same amount per share if we liquidated, we sold all the assets and liquidated the entity. If the rights allow, under any situation, no matter how unlikely to occur, then you have issued two classes of stock under these rules. Now, if your agreement doesn't allow for that, but the taxpayer has done it, the IRS is pretty clear that unless there is a side agreement, now this is where it gets messy, because obviously a side agreement can be by, you know, just coming to an agreement but not putting it in writing. If there's a side agreement, then we could still have two classes of stock. But generally, the service has ruled that as long as the party that got shorted in the distributions got less than they should have under the per share rule, as long as they have an absolute legal right to sue the corporation, come after and get the balance due, as long as the corporation doesn't ignore that, the parties don't then agree to ignore it, you don't have a one class of stock problem. They've clearly said before that, nope, there was no, you didn't blow your S election by making a disproportionate distribution, but you did blow it if there's the possibility to make one, whether or not one is made. Now, this particular case is going to blow both the rights and reality on these distribution rules. So yeah, we're going to have a couple of issues here. Now, let's talk about the facts of this ruling. In this case, an LLC was formed and initially filed a Form 8832 to elect corporate status. Given that this occurs on date one and the S election occurs on date two, it appears that for some period of time, this corporation was taxed as a C corporation, right? So it had some C corporation time in the mix. Now, weirdly though, the operating agreement included provisions that were clearly related to partnerships. This is like keeping capital accounts under 704B rules and, you know, having what were some special allocations of income, which then led to special rights of distribution. Now, that would be quirky for a C corporation, LLC, to be formed that way, but not really, it wouldn't really kill it. It would basically create effectively multiple classes of stock. We'd have different classes with different rights, right? We're just guessing at that, right? So that would be important. Now, also note one other thing about these different rights. The regulation nor the law ever talks about voting as a criteria for having different rights. Now, I guarantee you, under state law, certainly under Arizona state law, if your corporation issues stock that's voting and stock that's not voting, that's going to be considered two different classes of stock. But it's not, and that's legally, but it's not going to be two classes of stock for the S corporation as long as both classes have identical rights on a per share basis. So, yeah, we don't worry about voting. We worry just about these shares. So having some LLC members be managers and other LLC members be, in essence, be just members, right? No management op, no management rights. That doesn't hurt your election. Now, after this, though, they filed a Form 2553 to elect S status. They did not change their operating agreement. Now, I'll tell you, stop right here. At this point, they don't have an S corporation. Now, we'll talk about what they did, because they actually took advantage of those provisions, which is a bigger problem. But fundamentally, they already have a problem because under their operating agreement, just simple things like the 704B capital account maintenance rules, which will then require liquidation in accordance with those 704B capital accounts, is going to blow your S election, right? Those are going to be different rights. So that's a problem for us. So fundamentally, not getting off of where we're on right now, we don't have an S corporation. But the facts get worse. And the problem with the facts getting worse is we start to create a situation where we may not be able to get a private letter ruling. Because at a certain point, if certain things happen, especially if statutes close on tax returns before we notice the problem, it may not be possible to fix things. And I do not recall seeing a private letter ruling from the IRS where the IRS allowed you to go back and treat as if nothing bad happened if you were unable to correct the error because years were closed, right? We paid, different shareholders paid the wrong tax. I've never seen a ruling that let us get out. I'm not saying it doesn't exist, and somebody may come up with one. If you do, email me on it. But, I don't recall ever seeing that ruling. And I've read a lot of these rulings over the years. Okay? Now, while they thought the S election was in effect, so now we have this S election they've made, they believe in error they are an S corporation. While they're operating this S corporation that wasn't and filing 1120S, well, they did a couple of other things. First thing, which is a huge issue, the corporation issued K-1s showing special allocation of shareholders to the of income to the shareholders. Now, the current K-1s we now produce will make that fairly clear. The IRS will be able to figure that out right away because you're giving information about number of shares owned, and if they're owned during the whole year, nothing changed, etc. So mechanically, the service in many cases, if there was no change in shares during the year, everybody held their shares all year, which is normally what happens in arrests. If I have four people, each of whom claimed to own 250 shares, and they all owned it for the entire year, then everybody better get the same K-1 numbers. And if I'm finding wildly different numbers on different K-1s, I, as the IRS would say, that really begins to open up questions as to what's going on. They have wildly different distributions reported. It's like, okay, this looks like it's not an S corporation. And that is on the K-1s now. And that's part of the reason why it's there. But they also made disproportionate distributions. And it would appear probably just to come into line with their agreed allocations of income. A lot of people want to do the S because say, hey, as a partnership, we're paying self-employment tax on all this income. And my buddy said that, well, he formed an S corporation and he's taking no salary now. I know that doesn't work, right? Okay. But let's assume the neighbor is not an idiot, right? And I consider an idiot somebody who didn't get some advice on this thing, and who certainly the old line about, an attorney that has themselves for a client, an attorney who hires himself, represents themselves, has a fool for a client. That happens with taxpayers who try to essentially represent themselves in cases like this because, you know, they don't understand the rules, and there you get yourself in big trouble missing this rules. But let's assume that that guy did it right. He took a salary. He has a study. He knows exactly what would be a reasonable salary to have paid him for the work. Yes, I agree. In that case, he's getting out of self-employment tax on the earnings beyond the amount necessary to pay a reasonable salary for the work he's doing. Well, now our buddies here, let's say they're, you know, usually they're professionals that have these intricate rules because they want to make sure that everybody is only getting things that relate to their clients, reduced by expenses that relate to them, et cetera. So they have that whole intricate set of computations. You know, they said, oh, well, you know, we'll just make an S election. And that's why I say the buddy that's paying no wages, because that's like, that's easy. And then, you know, we just have our income come out. We don't get any more W-2s and we don't report, you know, we just report our income. We don't pay the SE tax. And probably if they piled up this badly, then, but we still fund our retirement plans. Another mess. But in any event, let's say we go there. So this is not good. And this presents the problem I talked about here. We're going to discover the IRS is going to want you to be able to fix this, right? Do corrections, go back and correct things retroactively, and you'll be given permission to do it. But generally, the service is not going to be able, is going to claim they can't give you permission to go back in a year that's already closed. I'm not sure that's totally true. You could enter into a negotiated closing agreement, I assume, but that's going to be way more complicated than this simple private letter ruling. So there is a big problem here. If they had continued this and the statute was now closed on the first year, on the first year for the S corporation, those shareholder returns had closed statutes, because now we can't have the person underpaid the tax paying the extra, and the IRS is not able to refund the tax the person that paid in too much. So we have a problem there. We can't fix the returns. Now they, at some point, I assume fairly quickly in this, so we didn't have that problem because it certainly wasn't mentioned. They admit that this created a second class of stock, and they did ask for relief under 1362F. 1362F is a provision of the Internal Revenue Code that allows the IRS to grant relief for inadvertently invalid S elections and inadvertent terminations, right? That the IRS can decide, if they decide that you legitimately were trying to make an S election, you legitimately were not trying to game the system or allow yourself, you know, to get the benefit of, you know, some sort of look back to figure out, you know, which would have been your better choice. They can, if you demonstrate this to them, they can allow you to go back and just be treated like the S election was always valid, but they can impose conditions in doing so. So what they've got there, 1362F, they put the request in saying, look, we made a mistake. We know we don't have an S corporation, but can you allow us to go back and treat it retroactively as if it had always been an S? Now, getting this relief, as I said, requires getting a private letter ruling. That will include, at a minimum, paying the user fee. And it probably is going to involve paying significant professional fees because somebody's got to shepherd this thing through the system. And, you know, that's going to take a lot of professional time, and a professional is going to be charging for it. And if we have a professional already, but they miss this whole thing for, like, you know, 2 years, then you're probably going to have professionals that found it suggest you don't want to rely upon them to fix this because, look, they don't understand it well enough to know they even had a problem until I came in and pointed it out. So, yeah, usually that involves other fees as well. Now, there are some cases where you don't need that. They will grant you automatic relief under 1361F. But this case does not meet that fact pattern. The big problem, the IRS had an expanded version they issued back in 22. That expanded the situations where you'd essentially get automatic relief. But this, but the fact pattern where there is a drafting problem with the rights provided in an operating agreement and invalidate your S election was specifically excluded from automatic relief. Whenever we have this problem, we have to go ask for relief. And even if we're looking for an inadvertent election, if we didn't actually file the returns that properly, as if it had been an S corporation under this, you know, basically the per day per share rule, absent the cutoff election if there's been a change in ownership, you know, if we hadn't at least done it that way consistently, you can't get them either. So this fact pattern with everything they did, there is no way out of this, right? You have got to go ask the IRS for relief, right? Because you had a special allocation and you paid out based on that. And it was actually in the document anyway. So yeah, we got it wrong. We have to go get a private letter ruling. Now the IRS did grant them relief and treated the S election as valid as of the first day that had been requested, but they imposed conditions. Number one, the operating agreement was revised, and this they did before asking for the ruling because you know this is going to be required. The operating agreement was retroactively revised to, in essence, eliminate the second class of stock problem. It basically defined what would be effectively, usually the way you try to do this, is you define units, you know, of equity ownership, and every unit has identical rights to income and identical rights distributions, and there is no, you know, no special allocations. You also eliminate the 704B language because A, it shouldn't be there. It's not a partnership. And B, when it is there, arguably it always opens up even if it's a very outside possibility of having a disproportionate distribution that is legally mandated to stay that way, right? In your agreement, should something happen. So yeah, the operating agreement was totally revised to be good for an S. That is something that honestly, anytime you're going to use an LLC as an S, make an S election, you need to get an operating agreement that is drafted by counsel that understands it's going to be used for an S elections, understands how S corporations work, and gives you that proper agreement. That's simply a given. For all prior year returns, including the 1040s of the shareholders, were revised to reflect the per share per day allocation of income that should have been on those K-1s consistent with how the operating agreement was now worded, right? So basically, yeah, we now have that redone. So that means that some shareholders would pay the extra tax, some shareholders would end up having a claim for refund, and all of those are filed with the service. And then a corrective distribution was paid. Generally, those that are going to end up paying tax to the IRS because they should have reported more income than they did, in this case, I'm going to bet, also got less distributions than they should have because, of course, we're paying attention to that special allocation that meant they got less income. So, yeah, we need to give them cash, too, to get them in line with the cash the other guys got. Whoever got the highest per share, effectively, is going to set your distribution each time. And we made corrective distributions to make that work. Those are all required before the service would grant. And if you read the ruling, which we have the links to, that is, you know, here in the materials we have on the website, talking about, you know, this issue of this case, if you go to the private lettering, you're going to discover that, yeah, they spell all those conditions out, the IRS does, when they actually give you their answer. Now, some key takeaways from this ruling, and this is the reason why we're spending time on it today, because as I said, we have these rulings where people screw up S's, though not quite as badly as this too often. First key takeaway, LLC operating agreements must be drafted to be specifically tailored to the entity type that you're going to elect under check the box. So make sure that counsel knows exactly which entity type you plan to choose, right? Don't just take an off-the-shelf operating agreement. And this is why those you can download from the internet are really, really bad. First thing, they might be very competent agreements, but if they are, they're going to make assumptions in this area. And I will tell you that most boilerplate agreements including ones that are provided to attorneys in, you know, sort of document packages, they're going to start by assuming you got a partnership here for tax purposes. And that's great if you do. It's probably suboptimal, but maybe not that big a problem if you only have one owner, because single member, they just, you know, they're going to get whatever's there, so who cares? But it's suboptimal. So, you know, and whenever you change entities, you really need to have somebody carefully review the operating agreement and make sure change fake entity type to this LLC. You need to have the operating agreement reviewed, and probably it needs to be amended. That's a given. You can't just change entity type and presume that we're just fine with the operating agreement that we have. That may be a little more likely if we're going to disregard it. Again, probably doesn't matter. But if you're going to corporation or partnership or S corporation, right, any of those things, or even certain special categories of partnerships or corporations, you know, you want to make sure the operating agreement works under that scenario and not just assume it does, right? Don't just assume you can do it. Believe it or not, there are reasons to pay counsel. Legitimate reasons to pay counsel. Rumored there's also legitimate reasons to pay CPAs and EAs. But hey, you know, that's what's there. An existing operating agreement must always, always, always be carefully reviewed and revised. If an entity now wishes to make an S election when it previously was not an S corporation, the same would be true if the entity wants to say they were elected to be a corporation and now they want to move back to partnership. Because, by the way, you move back to partnership, and we'll get to a problem there anyway here in a second, but let's ignore that for now. We're going to ignore the tax consequence of doing that one. If you go back there, I need the 704B capital account language in there if you are going to have any sort of special allocations. They're probably going to want that capital account language put back in the agreement. So these are all changes that should be reviewed whenever you make a check-the-box change. Also, this is really important. Remember, moving from one tax entity type to another requires going through the appropriate pretend transactions to get there. If I'm going to take my S corporation and now convert it to a partnership, I have to liquidate. I have to go through a pretend liquidation of a state law corporation. And for tax purposes, during that liquidation, I'm going to pay tax on any gain inside the corporation. That's automatic, because whenever you distribute assets to a shareholder, right, you have to recognize any gains inherent in those assets. You have to recognize all that inside the corporation. That's true if it's a C or S. And then I have to get the actual value of what's coming out the shareholder, compare that to the basis of their stock, and pay tax and then take into account any gain or loss on that. Now, in an S corporation, the one advantage is that inside gain we just triggered will increase our outside basis. So we won't really pay a double tax on that. The C corporation, you will, because that has no impact on the basis of the shares outside the corporation. So that'll be the key, right? That'll be there. These pretend transactions, and then you take those share, you know, everybody now owns, let's say you have four shareholders, each one owns 1/4 of every single asset. They then, and 1/4 of every liability, they then turn around and contribute those back to a new partnership under Section 721 and those rules. And while that's likely not taxable, it's not guaranteed to be not taxable. So you need to be very, very careful there, right? If we liquidate a partnership, let's say we take a partnership and we convert it to a corporation, then we have to decide we're going to factor it as if it is technically a contribute the partnership interest to the new corporation, then have it contribute shares, or we're going to have it contribute, have the assets flow out to the shareholders, consider the tax implication of any of that, and then have those recontributed under a 351 transaction. And both of those have issues. So, you know, we have to worry about that. And either one could be very, very expensive. So we need to understand those rules, not just ignore them, right? Yes, I know. Everybody who's taken a course on LLCs has heard that, well, you know, you, every 60 months, you have a right to change your election. But what people miss is nowhere in that course you took, nowhere, I can almost guarantee you, nowhere in that course you took did it ever say you weren't going to pay tax. You inserted that in there in your mind, we're not going to pay tax, right? Because I can change. I have a right to change every 6 months or every 60 months, which is true, but they never said you wouldn't pay tax. Gang, especially coming from corporate status, you are likely to pay a lot of tax getting there. So this has been the Current Flow Tax Developments for the week of June the 3rd, 2024. As I say, only a couple developments this week because it was a very short week. And I think a lot of people in DC were on vacation. So we'll see if things pick up this week. If you have any questions, you can email me, edzollers@currentflowtaxdevelopments.com. You also can, find me on the Connect sites for Arizona Society, New Jersey Society, the Idaho Society of CPAs, all of these are CPAs, Illinois Society, Washington Society, and Minnesota Society of CPAs. If you have questions there, you pose them. If I see them go up and I think I can help with an answer, I may respond there as well. Otherwise, we look forward to seeing you next week. We'll talk about whatever the IRS, Congress, somebody else comes up with, and the courts come up with next week on current federal tax developments.